Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. My name is Fred Axelgard. I'm with the Wheatley Institution, which is a research institute here on the campus at Brigham Young University, where we focus on policy issues affecting the family, religious freedom, and other issues of central significance to the core institutions of society. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this session on Egypt, Turkey, and Lebanon. I'll take just a brief moment to introduce our speakers, and then we will proceed to hear from them. Our first speaker this afternoon is Mohamed Abdelal. Mohamed is an assistant professor of constitutional and administrative law at Alexandria University Faculty of Law in Egypt. He earned his Bachelor of Law degree from Alexandria and a diploma in public law in 2010. He is now at Indiana University in Indianapolis, where he has received his Master of Laws degree, and he is currently a PhD, SJD PhD candidate. I think his thesis dissertation will make each one of you smile for its timeliness. His topic has to do with presidential impeachment, a comparison of from a constitutional framework between Egypt and the United States and Islamic law. After Mohamed, we will hear from Mr. Erdogan Arslan. He is vice president of the Turkey Yozgat City Platform. The Yozgat Platform is a non-governmental organization in the Yozgat province of Turkey. We look forward to hearing his presentation, which will be made in Turkish. And third, may I introduce to you Mr. Michel Touma. Mr. Touma is assistant editor-in-chief of L'Orient Le Jour, which is the leading French newspaper in Lebanon. He is also director and general editorial assistant. He is an editorial writer focusing on religious freedoms. He is also at Saint Joseph University in Beirut, where his research and writing focus on Middle Eastern law and religion issues, both for editorial content and observation. We have a rich opportunity to hear from these three gentlemen from a very important region of the world. I will ask each one of them if they would speak for approximately 10 minutes, after which we will have a discussion period, and I will introduce the format for that discussion when the time comes. For now, we'll turn the time to Mohamed Abdelal.
Thank you, Professor Fred. Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for being able to be here. Actually, my presentation is going to be a little bit different from what we already heard this morning, because I'm going to argue the issue of human rights from the perspective of the Egyptian constitution, which we are going to amend this month. So, for those who don't know Egypt is a transcontinental country that is located in the northeast corner of Africa, with the Sinai Peninsula in the southwest corner of Asia. The population of Egypt is right now about 90 million, and 90% of the population are Muslims, with only 10% Christians, and Arabic is a native and the dominant language of Egypt. On January 25th, 2011, we had a revolution in Egypt. Probably most of you guys heard about the revolution of Egypt in 2011, where Egyptians just flooded in the Egyptian streets, just, you know, angry and enraged over the regime of President Mubarak, the ex-president. And the outcomes of this revolution were that Mubarak has completely stepped down, delegating his power to the military forces, and the Islamists in Egypt just started to rise as a major power. A democratic election has been held in Egypt, and President Mohamed Morsi, which belongs to the Muslim Brotherhood, just got elected and inaugurated as Egypt's first president. Also, In June 2013, we had another revolution where people became very angry from the actions of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and President Mohamed Morsi saw people again demonstrated in the streets and asking President Morsi to step down, allowing an early presidential elections. Under the pressure of the people, the army just interfered and declaring that, you know, President Morsi is no longer the president of Egypt. And right now, the current president is the chief justice, and we are waiting to amend our constitution and to have a presidential and a parliamentary election. So right now, you know, I'm trying to give some recommendations for the new drafters on how to avoid the mistakes committed by the Islamists when they drafted the Constitution of 2012, especially in the issue of human rights. So Article 2 of the 2012 Constitution reads as follows. Islam is the religion of the state, and Arabic is its official language, and the principles of Islamic Sharia are the main source of legislation. So, in fact, the onset of the article, which reads Islam is the religion of the state and Arabic is its official language, has never been the problem, simply because it just mirrors or it just reflects the status quo of Egypt that Islam is the majority religion and Arabic is the dominant language. However, the last part of the article, which reads the principles of Islamic Sharia are the main source of legislation, is to a great extent controversial. In fact, Egypt's liberals and Christians see the last part of this article as the main incident towards the Islamization of the constitution. However, what alleviated the worries of Egypt's liberals and Christians is that a neutral entity, which is the Supreme Constitutional Court in Egypt, just reserved to itself the power to interpret Article 2, and it didn't frustrate Egypt's liberals and Christians when it came up with a liberal interpretation to Article 2. So the court just adopted a secular approach in interpreting Article 2, when it limited the definition of the principles of Islamic Sharia to include only those authentic rules that are beyond doubt and are likely to generate only one meaning if interpreted. Also, the Supreme Court reached its acme when it just argued that all laws in Egypt and all regulations should promote for human justice and welfare. So the interpretation of the Supreme Court to Article 2, as I said, didn't frustrate Egypt's liberals and Christians. However, when the Islamists gained power in Egypt, they just tried to impose a new agenda and a new strict interpretation to Article 2, which, of course, against Egypt's liberals and Christians. So let's start by talking briefly about the freedom of speech in the 2012 Constitution. One of the most controversial freedoms in the Constitution of 2012 is the freedom of belief, as Egypt's liberals and Christians see that the new Constitution restricts that freedom. However, the Islamists in Egypt see that the Constitution of 2012 promotes and supports the freedom of belief. The Constitution of 2012 mentions freedom of belief in Article 43, which reads, freedom of belief is an inviolable right. The state shall guarantee the freedom to practice religious rites and to establish places of worship for the different religions as regulated by law. On the one hand, according to the traditional rules of a statutory interpretation, the plain meaning rule seems suitable to be applied on the first part of the article, which reads, freedom of belief is an inviolable right. On the other hand, one could see the last part of the article, which reads, the state shall guarantee the freedom to practice religious rites and to establish places of worship for the different religions as regulated by law as a restriction on freedom of belief. In fact, this phrase may be seen as a restriction on the freedom of belief simply because it requires the state to guarantee the freedom of belief. To guarantee the freedom to practice religious rites and to establish places of worship only for the different religions like Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. Consequently, those who believe in undivine religions are neither allowed to practice their religious rites nor to establish their places of worship. However, one shouldn't confuse between the right of belief and the right to practice religious rites, simply because according to the text of Article 43, the right to believe is guaranteed and protected for all citizens, whether they believe in a different religion or in undivine religion. Even the right to atheism is guaranteed under Article 43. However, those who believe in different religions like Islam, Christianity, and Judaism are only allowed to publicly practice their religious rites and to establish their places of worship. Another provision that could be seen as a curtailing the freedom of belief in Egypt is Article 3, which reads, the canon principles of Egyptian Christians and Jews are the main source of legislation for their personal status law, religious affairs, and the selection of their spiritual leaders. On the first side, a cursory examination of the article reveals that it supports the freedom of belief, as Egypt's non-Muslim Christians and Jews are allowed to defer to the rules and laws of their canons, rules of religion in deciding the issues of their personal affairs and the selection of their spiritual leaders. On the other hand, one could see this article as restriction on the freedom of belief simply because it just acknowledged Christianity and Judaism to be religious beside Islam in Egypt. However, you know, the article ignores other faiths in Islam like the Baha'i faiths. So, right now, you know, those who believe in something other than Islam, Christianity, or Judaism in Egypt are not allowed to defer to the principles of their religion in deciding their personal affairs, so they are obliged to be subject to Islamic law in courts. Indeed, I am not either arguing against this article or supporting it because I don't see it as a restriction for the on the freedom of belief. Simply because, you know, acknowledging Christianity and Judaism as religious beside Islam is just a matter of a state ideology. For example, here in the United States, some states like Texas and Indiana just banned the difference to Sharia law in the U.S. courts. So I think it's just a matter of a state ideology. So I don't see Article 3 in the 2012 Constitution as a restriction on the freedom of belief in Egypt. Well, another controversial issue in the Egyptian constitution is the right of detainees, or the right of the arrested people. Despite that, the 2012 constitution requires that all detainees must be treated in such a way that preserves their human dignity, that they shouldn't be subject to either physical or moral harm. However, the same constitution provides that all arrested persons should be informed in writing by the reasons of their detention within 12 hours of the time of their detention, and also to be presented to the interrogation authority within 24 hours of the time of their arrest. In fact, I see these time limits unreasonable because the Constitution itself doesn't tell us why we should wait like 12 hours before informing the detained person with the reason of his detention, and why we should wait like 24 hours before delivering him to the interrogation authority. So I think these time limits may create a margin for the detention authority to abuse the detained person before delivering him to the interrogation authority. So this is another issue that the new drafters of the Egyptian constitution should be aware of, which is the right of the arrested person or the right of detainees. Well, another controversial issue is the principle of equality. Well, in order to shed light on the principle of equality in Egypt, we should make a flashback on the constitution of 1971, the Egyptian constitution of the 1971. Actually, Article 4 of this constitution provides that all citizens are equal before law. They have the same rights and the same duties without discrimination between them based on their sex, religion, and race. However, the Constitution of 2012 provides that all citizens are equal before law. They have the same rights and the same duties without discrimination. So it's obvious that the Constitution of 2012, which was drafted by the Islamists in Egypt, overlooked the phrase in Article 40 of the 1971 Constitution, which provides that there shouldn't be any discrimination between citizens based on their sex, religion, and race. So the current Constitution, which is the Constitution of 2012, in somewhat allow the discrimination between citizens based on their sex, religion, and race. So I think this article, which is Article 33 of the 2012 Constitution, just to serve the hidden ideology of the Islamists in Egypt that non-Muslims are not allowed to run for the presidency office. So Christian people in Egypt and Jewish people in Egypt are not allowed to run for the presidency office, and the Constitution of 2012 allows the authorities to discriminate between Muslims people in Egypt and non-Muslim in this issue. Well, finally, the freedom of belief in the 2012 Constitution. The Constitution of 2012 guarantees the rights of citizens to express their thoughts, views, and opinions. Additionally, the Constitution of 2012 emphasized that the freedom of creativity is a right to every citizen and should be guaranteed by the state. Despite this, the range of freedom of media and the press remains to some extent questionable. The Constitution of 2012 mentions the freedom of media and the press when it reads, freedom of the press, printing, publication, and mass media shall be guaranteed. The media shall be free and independent to serve the community and to express the different trends in public opinion and contribute to shaping and directing in accordance with the basic principles of the state and society. So despite acknowledging the media in its various forms as an independent and a free entity in Egypt, the Constitution of 2012 overlooks one of the most urgent claims, namely that imprisonment for publication crimes must be prohibited. Indeed, this claim seems to be reasonable, especially since it guarantees journalists' ability to work free from the grip of the government or the judicial persecution. Furthermore, the Constitution of 2012 lists the requirements of national security as a possible curb on the freedom of media and the press, that this freedom should be practiced or should be exercised in accordance with the requirements of national security. However, the Constitution doesn't explicitly mention what are the requirements of national security. So this will gonna lead to extended interpretation, which might be lead to a restriction on the freedom of expression in Egypt. So the new drafters in Egypt should, or the new drafters of the new Constitution of Egypt should clarify what is the meaning of the requirements of national security, which will be, which the freedom of expression should be practiced in accordance to it. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Değerli misafirlerimiz.
Dear guests, I would like to start my presentation by bringing regards and greetings from Turkey to you. My name is Erdoğan Arslan. I am a retired military officer. I would like to share my own opinions as a simple citizen from lifelong experiences. Yesterday and today, some of the examples which the speakers gave came from Turkey and Islam. My family, myself and people around us have never experienced any difficulty in living our religion. I also think that people who belong to other religions don't have any difficulty in living their religions in Turkey because tolerance is very important in my country. In many cities, like in Antakya and Istanbul, the churches, the mosques, and synagogues are side by side. I don't think you can find this kind of tolerance and understanding anywhere else, because I know that Muslims who are living in different countries have difficulty in fulfilling their religious obligations. Atatürk founded the Turkish Republic on 29th of October 1923 and brought secularism. According to the Turkish Constitution, Article number 24, fifth clause, under the title of the freedom of religion and conscience, everybody has freedom of religion and speech. People cannot force to worship or attend religious ceremonies. They cannot be forced to have a religious faith or opinion. They cannot be condemned or accused because of their faith or opinions. Religious and ethics education and religious training are given under the supervision of the government. Religious and ethics education is compulsory in elementary and middle schools. The other religious education and training are only offered if the individual makes a request.
No, someone like something. Okay.
Actually, the freedom of conscience and religion, its relation with Islam has always been controversial, and it will always be controversial. The secularism in Turkey means that government cannot interfere with religious affairs in terms of education, teaching, and public service. However, time to time we have had problems with religious headscarf and stating one's religion on personal ID cards, as this subject was mentioned with some examples yesterday. 10 days ago, a new law passed, and it now gives freedom to wear turban anywhere except military, police, and legal places. A former regulation, ID cards didn't have your religion written, and if someone doesn't want their religion to be written, then they can request to be blank. Actually, the essential solution is not the changes in laws, but the changes in people's mentality. In addition, the birth of Christianity and its progress persecuted many other religions, and in result of this, secularism was born. Of course, the birth of secularism took a long time for the countries to adopt. the freedom of conscience and religion, its relation with Islam has always been controversial, and it will always be controversial. Before the Republic of Turkey, the Ottoman Empire respected other religions and allowed them worship, and they were able to be recognized as a religion. Even they were given sovereignty based on their religion. Secularism in Turkey means that government cannot interfere with religious affairs in terms of education, teaching, and public service. On the other hand, the religion cannot interfere with rules and laws of the land. This truth, along with constitutional judgments, emphasized the decision made by Supreme Court. Since 1924 Constitution, there is a ministry called Religious Affairs. The secularism established by Atatürk, the founder of the modern Turkey, said that the following. Number one, religion has been used and is being used for the affairs of politics. There are people and groups have politic interests who use this religion for their benefits. Number two, our society is dependent upon religion, and they are sensitive in this subject, and hence they can abuse the system. Because of this, the principle of sovereignty with no clause is for the citizens of the country, is accepted, and the Republic of Turkey is founded. Atatürk showed that there is no favoritism against any person or group, and there cannot be any privileges can be given to them. And this is written in Atatürk's declaration. Atatürk knew in terms of Turkish prosperity, education, and science that as just in other countries in the history, in the name of religion, there could be some superstitions that would impede the progress of the country. He also knew that and stated in his declaration that public sincere feelings would be misused by the politicians, and he showed many examples of that. By this, we understand that the Republic of Turkey has attributes that belong in constitutions, second and fourth articles, that there is no overarching freedom of religion and expression. The human rights are brought by the rules in the government with the nature of being a human, and they are independent. For the person to be progress individually, there is one clause that the human rights only can be found in democratic states. The rules of human rights states that there's a basic equality, and this is global, and there is a moral attribute. All rules protecting the people's dignity are included in the human rights. Dignity is important to understand whether the rules of law are appropriate, and this is a great tool for the justification of the rules. Anybody, any organization, or any government doesn't have the freedom to destroy any freedom. The human rights goes back to our origins. The first time we saw human rights was among the Sumerians. There are tablets from Sumerians that show the relationships between the laborer, experts, and the employer. There were many human rights in Turkestan, where the Turks believe this to be the motherland. There were many instances with different religions that lived under one government. Nevertheless, the governments that the Turks organized previously in the history were secular in nature. In modern age, in 2004, Turkey and Spain had started a union of civilizations as an international forum, and this union has the most memberships besides the United Nations. At past, there was a controversy in regards to the cartoon article being printed, and now our Prophet Muhammad is filmed. There were some Islamic phobias. With these instances, there were a need of understanding and tolerance. Because of this and because of the reason, I am happy to be here. I know that this conference is very important. Islamic phobia is poisonous and dangerous threat for the relations between the Islam and the Western countries. Just like anti-Semitism, Islamic phobia also is a type of racism and crime against humanity. In the morning, people were talking about Bible, and the Bible mentions about human love. In Quran, which Muslims believe as a sacred scripture, also mentions about the love. One of the verses in Quran states that, "Say, O Muhammad, I don't ask you for this message any payment, but only goodwill through kinship. And whoever commits a good deed, we will increase for him good therein. Indeed, Allah is forgiving and appreciative." Islam also plays importance in being a good neighbor. If you have a neighbor who is hungry, he is not mine, says the Quran. One of the wise men called Mevlana say that, "Come, whatever reason you have, just come. There is no discrimination among people, and there is tolerance among them." In summary, as a Turkish and Muslim, I love anyone regardless of their religion and races. And I expect the same respect and love from you. Thank you for listening. Thank you.
Bonsoir. Moi, je vais parler en français. Donc, je voudrais commencer d'abord par remercier.
I would like to speak in English, and I would like to thank Brigham University to allow me to come to this symposium. And I would also like to thank all the volunteers, the students of this university, and all the things that they did to prepare this symposium. I know how much work is requested to prepare this, and I really, really wanted to thank the young and the old volunteers. My theme will be divided into two parts. First of all, I'm going to talk about the context in the Middle East, in the shadow of what we called the Arabic Spring, the Arab Spring, that have brought forth to the surface in the last couple of years. And second, I would like to talk about the Lebanese model, about the political organization in Lebanon, and how this model could be one of the solutions of plural systems that have different communities. So, let me start first about the countries of the Middle East and how to understand the model of Lebanon could be a solution. Since the upheavals of the Arab Spring, we have seen the growth, the birth of the strengthening of organizations, of groups, of political movements, Islamic political movements, that that are integrating political systems in the Middle East. I would like to explain that these organizations already existed underground, But with the Arab Spring, these movements were strengthened a lot more. Some people could say that because of the birth, the emergence of these groups, there could be a negative impact of the Arab Spring. And I think that it would be too quick to say. The Arab Spring for the Arabic world for the last 50 years was political hibernation. All countries besides Lebanon was led by dictatorial regimes that were set up by in the 50s by the end of colonization, European colonization. And military coup set up dictatorial regimes that transformed into mafia powers that whose backbone consisted of the repressive family clans that suppressed aggressively any dissenting tone. For example, Saddam Hussein had the power, and that his family had the power to keep this system going. And when the people of Saddam Hussein simply entered the central bank of Iraq because he thought that it was part of his clan and part of his family. In Tunisia, I believe that you also understand that the regime, there was a familial family mafia system in Syria. Let's not even address it. I'm sure you're all aware of it, that the structure of the state was the clan of the current leader set up systems that were parallel to the government system to follow the system that was set up politically. I recommend to read The State of Barbarian Systems, which explains that the Assad clan in Syria, that was based on the Alawite system, had set up a clan of a mafia system that broke down the civil system. And this system still exists currently. And Bashar adds chemical weapons to that. So I don't want to go into too many details, but in Arabic countries, we had these mafia clans. Thus, when the Arab Spring started in 2011, we should not be surprised that that all countries that have seen revolutions have also seen massacres and other tragedies. But we can understand that there is an inflation of political organizations that grew, that were born in Tunisia, for example. No Tunisians are among us, but even we saw a lot of new political groups that were born, same in Egypt. Our colleague here is probably more aware of that than I am, and we can see that this still continues today. So the religious group should not scare us to enter the political programs. I think it's a normal system. It is a normal setup to see. If we want to simplify the situation, there is an arm wrestle currently in the Middle East between three systems. And we could apply this to all our Arabic countries. First, extremist Islamic groups that do not allow the differences, that does not allow that wants to impose by the force its values, and I refer to Al Qaeda and other organizations around that we sometimes call Salafist, although perhaps the Salafist name is not very appropriate. However, they are extremist groups. For example, in Lebanon, the Hezbollah, that by the use of arms, by explosions, liquidation, and threats, want to impose their way of life. The second Islamist system that I would like to call more moderate accepts the democratic game, which is the case of Turkey and perhaps a little bit in Tunisia as well. These they play the game to access the power. In Egypt, that hasn't been a success yet, but it's part of the game. However, this this non school of thought trend, the third one is a liberal trend that also exists in Egypt and Tunisia, in even in Libya. Talks about a civil state, which is the model of Western civilization. These are the three models that are emerging, that are evolving in the Middle East after the Arab Spring.
So here, looking at the Lebanese model here, which can be a solution to a society that is a little bit a pluralist society and heterogeneous, before we talk about the Lebanese model, before we understand this model, because it is not, especially in the West, where people are really surprised by this model. To understand this model, I only have two remarks here. First, we shouldn't forget that we in the Middle East, as it's indicated, we are Oriental people, like it's indicated there. Where the three religions, monotheistic religions, it is really the crib of these three monotheistic religions. This indicates that the religion in this part of the world has great importance in the in everyday life of people. We should not forget that. So when we want to judge a certain model, we shouldn't model that looking through Western glasses. We should forget a few Occidental criteria and transpose ourselves in another sphere, physically or mathematical, which is the Middle East model, the Oriental model. So we shouldn't forget that we are in the Middle East. And because we are there, second point, because we're in an Oriental setting, the familial allegiance and clans are very strong. The ties there to the clan and to families are very strong. In the Ebu Khandroum, Tunisian socialist, he studied what he called the Asabiya, which can be translated the spirit, the group spirit, the fact that we belong to a group that is well specified, which is the strong feeling of allegiance to that group or community, which we call in Arabic this Asabiya. This allegiance is very important to keep in mind As we study the political structure, we need to keep that in mind. In light of all this structure, how is the Lebanese model, how is it set up? So Lebanon is set up of 18 religious communities. There is about four Muslim communities and about 14 Christian communities with Orthodox, Catholic, Orthodox, and all those different trends and varieties. And so there are 14 Christian communities and four Muslim communities. And so we start with the principle that we refuse to do the ostrich politics, where we start with the constatation that we have really a society with 18 official communities, including the Coptic community, which is recognized officially as one of the communities. So we start with that constatation, with that observance, and we refuse to be to put our heads in the sand. And so second constatation is that we distinguish between these communities participating in on the public sphere, and they can exist, live, eat, and drink, and without having a role in the cultural and politic aspect of life. We start from the point that they should also participate in those aspects of life, political, social, and cultural, and not just granting them the right to eat and drink and live around us without any role. And so, starting with that point, how is the Lebanese model formed? First, political power is shared equally between Christians and Muslims. So the president is always Christian, and the chamber, president of the chamber, is always Muslim. And then each community is represented through the parliament according to a predetermined quota. And so within the administration, all communities are represented. In addition to that, each of the communities in Lebanon has its own schools, universities, TVs, radios, its own sport clubs, associations, and charitable organizations, etc., all other cultural clubs. And all communities are represented and have a role to play at all on all levels of the socioeconomic life. From our point of view, to kind of tie to the symposium theme, this model, which means everybody's participation in all aspects of life, medical, university, each university has its own hospitals also, you need to note that. This makes it easy to respect human rights and community rights. And my conclusion here shows that this model shows an example of where human rights are respected in a pluralist society and heterogeneous. Just one, once again, a model in which a model of a pluralist society. This model is now supported by moved by two factors here. The Islamic movements here, including Al-Qaeda and organizations such as, and secondly by Hezbollah type parties whose allegiance to political from a political point of view is not a Lebanese allegiance. It's and as written in their political guide, and they refer to the supreme judge in Iran, and they are he's the one who decides whether the members of Hezbollah should participate into a particular trend or attack or go fight. This kind of brings an imbalance in the Lebanese model, and which also discredits central government. And these are kind of the two trends that kind of threatens the Lebanese model, and also threatens the West and the Western values that we also share in Lebanon. Thank you very much.
minutes for discussion. Let me ask that as you have a question, please wait for the mic to come to you so that the translators can hear that. And identify yourself and your country, if you would, please. Thank you. Who has the first question, please?
Mr. Abdullah, you mentioned Section 44, I believe, of the 12 Constitution is the one on religious liberty. It ends as may be defined by or according to law. In my experience, that is an opportunity for the state to then regulate religion, because religion is then regulated according to law, and a constitutional aspect should be absolute freedom with no regulation. Would you like to comment on that and whether that's a concern?
You know, the article states that, you know, if, you know, Christians people or Jews people just wanted to establish places of worship, it's the state commitment to, you know, to guarantee them this right. I mean, you know, they have, you know, to give them the license to build these places of worship. So that's how, you know, in Egypt, the state, you know, just regulate, you know, the religion. It's just a matter of, you know, regulations, you know, just to give them the license to establish the places of worship. So.
My name is David Rottermel from the United States. For Mr. Tuma, you mentioned the institutional roles of the Christian and Muslim communities within Lebanon. Is there a similar institutionalized role for the Druze community?
Of course. Of course. They have their own quota in the parliament, the government, the administration. Of course. They have their own party, radio, of course. Yes.
Jakub Krot of Russia. Mr. Tuma, do you really think that it is possible to apply the Levant model, for example, to Syria, Israel, Turkey, that is universal for the Eastern countries?
Yeah. Okay, so I heard in English. Okay, I can manage it. I think in countries like Syria, it could be a solution to have a sort of. But you know, in Lebanon, we have an ever-old tradition, and I couldn't explain this because I didn't have time. But we have a very old tradition of communitarianism. The whole system in Lebanon is built on communitarism. It's not new. It is not new. But I think that because in Lebanon we don't have a minority, because we have a balance between Muslims and Christians, this model can be implemented. In Syria, it could be implemented if there is a will. In Israel, it's another story in Israel. In Israel, I don't think that it could be implemented, because if you want to implement this in Israel, that means that you have to build one state between the Jews and the Palestinians, which is impossible, I think. Okay. So, but in any pluralistic society, this model could be implemented if there is a tradition about this. And so to answer the question, in Syria it could be implement, and I think it is the solution, because the Christians in Syria, Bashar al-Assad says that he is defending Christian, but it is nonsense and it's bullshit. The Syrians in Syria, they have no role. They have maybe one minister only, but they have no role. They could have a big role in Syria and in establishing the new state. So in Syria, it could be.
Lynn Nori from Iran. Sir, you mentioned Muslim phobia, and I agree with many of the statements that you made in regards to that. My question to you is, what can the government do of countries who are primarily Muslim to change the stereotype or the impression that non-Muslim countries or non-Muslim citizens have about Muslims?
They can attend different symposiums. They can attend like different conferences. That's the only way we can do it. If we don't do this, when we attend these meetings, we take some decisions, and then we express our expressions. So we have to make some decisions. But through these meetings and conferences, we have to attend anywhere. And we can teach people about Islam, that Islam has a lot of goodness and there's a lot of tolerance against other religions. And if people have like different phobias against Islam, that can be resolved. And if we don't, then we will have same issues.
I'm going to answer in French so that I can answer a little bit faster. There are two things. First, it's not about countries where Christians and Muslims live together. It's not about just tolerating them, allowing them to live in that country. It's about allowing them to participate in all aspects of society. So not, without putting any stumbling block such as, he cannot become president. Oh, he cannot have a church here. Because in certain countries, we cannot even build churches, just such as Saudi Arabia. So it's not just about tolerating the other. It's about accepting them in their differences, but also allowing them to play a role in all aspects of society with no conditions or constraints. And secondly, what Muslim states can do is first, in a clear way, in their behavior, is to give a counterpart of organization. That we need to have a cultural revolution internally in Muslim society so that we can break that idea and break from that idea because people amalgamate Al-Qaeda and Islam and Muslims. And it's the Muslims' role to break that stereotype in their behavior to show that Al-Qaeda is not a phenomenon that belongs to Islam. In Lebanon, for example, we had organizations, Sunni organizations, that were rejected by Sunnis even before Christians were faced to those by those. No ambiguity there. So it's these kind of opportunities that avoid stereotypes like this.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Join me in thanking our panelists, if you would, please. And thank you for your participation and interest as well. We look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Thank you.